Well, first of all, I want to thank you for your invitation to bring this literally brand new idea to this table for a discussion. And we hope that what we contribute here will be just a sort of an opening and an ongoing relationship that we have with each of you as individuals or as a continuing group. If you Googled me, you might think that I am the 64th woman to have climbed Mount Everest. That would be untrue. Imagine my shock. I don't know if she had the same middle initial, but yeah, no, I know. But in fact, what I've been doing for several decades is climbing the mountains of data that exist, particularly in the campaign finance arena, through groups like the Center for Responsive Politics, where I was for, I think, 15 or 16 years. That's where I first took to heart what Justice Brandeis said: sunlight is the best disinfectant, electric light the most efficient policeman. And when I met Mike over lunch in September, he quoted the first part of that quote, and I am probably one of the few people in Washington who could have finished the quote for him. So we knew we were destined to work together. At the Center for Responsive Politics, I remember some of the first data analysis we did, and they had these funny little cards in which campaign finance information was being processed. And I confess to missing the 8-pound books we used to produce, which were called Open Secrets. It's now obviously all on the opensecrets.org website. But the data told a very powerful story about what happens in Washington and why. Who gets the goodies, who picks up the bill, and the more I studied the numbers, the more outraged I was, and the public became. My work since that time, both at Public Campaign, where Mika and I worked together, and Campaign for America's Future, and in the world of journalism at TomPaine.com and The American Prospect, has been experiments in how to drive the message of what the numbers tell us, how to drive that number home, a message home. Now having a role in creating the Sunlight Foundation in the information age, it really kind of brings me home. A longtime friend and mentor, Elizabeth Drew, whose book called Money and Politics really turned me on to this field in the early 80s, told me recently, as Mike and I were putting this together, she said, lawmakers will continue to do what they do as long as they can get away with it. And that was all it took to encourage me even further, to go further. Absolutely without sunlight, there will be no change. Our goal really is to break down the firewall, as the title of this presentation says, that Congress has put around itself, to develop the new tools, the information, the resources to allow a greater scrutiny of Congress's activities that heretofore has not been possible, and to nurture a community of people who will demand the information and participate in becoming their own investigators. It's time to move into the information age. And while we will advocate for reforms that increase transparency for lawmakers, we want to figure out ways to digitize Congress by leveraging modern technology. Not that kind of digitation. Digitization, nor that kind. But our goal is real transparency, to help Congress be more accessible and accountable to the public it serves. And we really mean that. I mean, we hope that members of Congress will see us as their allies as opposed to their enemies. We want to expose the quo for the quid pro quo. We want real transparency. And these are some of the ideas that we have. We need to know who's giving them money, and we do to some degree know that. We need to know who they're meeting with. We have no clue. We need to know the letters they write. I FOIA'd Tom DeLay and Bob Ney this last year. I think it was about 10 months ago, and I'm still getting responses that they can't find any correspondence from either of those members of Congress. We need to know who's lobbying them. We don't really have that information. Who takes them on trips. We need to know what they're doing for people who do nice things for them. Who's getting government contracts and why. That's just a beginning list. And we need to do this in a way, it's one thing to get the information reported, but we need to do it in a way where we can put this information together so that it has some meaning for citizens. And that means bills and congressional reports that are in a searchable text format as opposed to PDF files. It means converting the data into shareable formats using XML and getting APIs written so that different sets of data can be combined. This would be real transparency. Imagine a world in which you could push a single button on a member of Congress and find out which interest group gives him the most money, which of his staff has joined corporate America as a lobbyist, whether he's invested in the healthcare industry or maybe renting an apartment from a lobbyist. You could find out whether he's taken rides on corporate jets, whether he's been treated to expensive golfing vacations, been treated whether lobbyists who appear before his committee to lobby pieces of legislation, are contributing to his leadership pack, and perhaps whether, just perhaps, he's done some special favor for them legislatively. That has been my goal, you know, since the early 80s when I went to the Center for Responsive Politics. It's that one button push. And we want to tap into the power of citizen networks. I have been in this field long enough to know that there is a public outrage over what members of Congress do for people, but people feel generally powerless to do anything about it. And our hunch is if we can nurture the public into a powerful investigative force, that we will have unleashed not only something the public can do, but a whole change in congressional behavior. For sure, there are some investigations that can only be done by single investigative reporters like a Cy Hirsch. But in many cases, I think what you need is the sort of mini army of diligent researchers who help collect bits of information that add up to a larger picture. And one thing we know now that we didn't know 15 years ago is that we can no longer rely on the media to do this job. At one time, we did, as citizens, rely on the media to get to this. We can't do that anymore. Imagine, as a result of this, the Transportation Appropriations Bill, we have heard that there are at least 100 earmarks for lane widenings at seemingly random places around the country. Well, what if we put out a list, you know, of those intersections, and we said, tell us what's going on. Send us pictures. Figure out why we're going from a two-lane road to a three-lane road. I mean, I'm betting that we're going to find a whole new group of Walmarts that are going up. And we can't, no journalists, no sort of centralized location in Washington or any place else could figure that out. But that, to me, is a way to bring citizens in. That kind of, I'm thinking of it as distributive reporting. Or imagine this. A site where comprehensive information is available on every single member of Congress, whether it's gathered and stored, all those great investigative stories that have had one day shelf life and then disappeared from websites, and where citizens have a chance to add information about what their lawmakers are doing, for example, during their homework periods, what they're saying about the issues of the day in town hall meetings. And imagine that the day before Election Day, Veronica Voter goes to the Internet, Googles up there her member of Congress, and this information, because it's been well linked, appears up on her screen, and she gets a whole lot of information that she needs before she goes to the poll. We actually have a project to make this happen, but it's a bit still under wraps. And not quite ready for public consumption or discussion. Next slide. Our work is cut out for us. Information about lawmakers today is done in a way that deliberately obfuscates and confuses. Some examples. See if you can follow me. House campaign contributions are reported electronically to the Federal Election Commission. PACs and political parties report electronically to the Federal Election Commission. So far, so good. However, senators file their campaign finance records on paper with the Secretary of the Senate, and then the Secretary of the Senate hands that information to the Federal Election Commission, which pays an outside firm to put all of this into an electronic format. Let's could even put aside the issue of the waste of taxpayer money. However, information on gifts, travel, legal expense funds, personal financial disclosure reports are all filed on paper, and were it not for the private organizations, would never be available in electronic form. There is one exception, however. If you want to know the foreign travel for House members, that is filed electronically. You just got to figure out where to find it. So one project that the Sunlight Foundation has already embarked on is to help the Center for Responsive Politics to digitize all the personal financial disclosure information, the travel records, and to update its lobbying database. We are looking for ways to create a database out of revolving door information and government contracts as well. I thought it might be kind of fun for you to just sort of see what it looks like if you went to the Federal Election Commission. To show you how bad the accessibility is to current information. As you can see, a search here on the FEC's website brings you to an actual scanned page of the records, one page at a time. If you went to further, you said, I want to see campaign contributions filings from Tom DeLay's PAC. It takes you to that page. I've been in this issue for two decades. I don't have a clue what those reports would reveal. If you go to the Senate's online search site for searching lobbyist registration, you get something that looks like that. A frustrating table of raw reports and filings, all again in PDF form. I think those are some lobbyist named Jack Abramoff.
Jack A. Abramoff.
Oh, right. Brother. Right. And if he didn't use his A, we might miss some of those. Like I said, all that's hidden in plain view. And if you wanted to know about government contracts, there is a database actually maintained by the Pentagon for every contractor who gets a contract over $25,000. But if you Google the terms contractor Pentagon database, you'll never find it. But if you get to this page, you need to get a new ink cartridge for your printer because the only thing you can do with it is to download all 3,000 pages of it. Needless to say, that's not acceptable in the information age. And as I said earlier, the private groups, and here are some of the major ones, most of which are nonprofit, some of which are for-profit, make this information available, but at substantial cost and huge time delays because the information has to literally be entered by hand. From most of these records, what we don't know will hurt us. Now, I actually tried to read this last night. This is, as we know, there are known unknowns. There are things we know. We know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know, but there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. We didn't make that up. That's for real. That is for real. And what we don't know will hurt us. I think that's what Rumsfeld was trying to say, but you may have a better take on it. So what do we need to know? In addition to the information that's now reported on campaign finance and personal financial disclosure, and travel and gifts and trips, which is, that has to be all filed electronically in this century. But we also need to know who lawmakers are meeting with and why. What are they talking about? We need to see every piece of correspondence a lawmaker has with a regulatory agency. We need to know particularly if a legislative action has a benefit for a particular company or an individual. And we need to know it now. Currently, lobbying reports are filed twice a year, and I made the argument in a meeting with five Democratic senators that actually I'd like to see their calendars posted on the Internet, and if not, I'd like to see who they're meeting with and all of this on a daily or even weekly basis. It was the most radical suggestion for reform in the room. So our plan is initially to invest in new data collection to get new information, to get existing information in a digitized form and get new information up and out there. We need to invest in getting this data to relate to each other, to figure out how to mash the data together so that you can fulfill my dream of pushing one button and finding everything you want to know about your member of Congress or a corporation or a particular lobbyist. We need to find ways to involve citizens as their own muckrakers and reporters. We need to find ways to get the information out of Washington and off the internet and into people's living rooms and even perhaps their hometown newspapers, if there are any left. We need to push Congress to disclose more and reward the members who do that. We need to push more investigative reporting and blogging about Congress and its lawmakers. And we need to help galvanize a national campaign to push the issues of transparency so that more members of Congress will, in fact, feel the need and the public pressure to do more disclosure. I'm going to turn this to Mike at the moment, with the mic, to conclude, to sum up on our goals, what we hope to achieve.
Well, obviously, we hope to, by virtue of making more information available, to build a reinforcing cycle, beginning with citizen participation in the political process and greater responsiveness. One of the things that motivated me, and I'm sure motivated all the rest of us, is that the few stories that are written about the subject of who did what for what relative to Congress are generalized. They're not well detailed. They appear, for the most part, in a few East and West Coast newspapers where there are resources. And so both enhancing the accessibility of this information for the media generally, as well as reporters and bloggers, we hope will not only be its own value, but create more interest, more outrage, because you can't pick up the paper any day and not be outraged. Just today, there's a story in the New York Times or the Washington Post about $7 billion worth of oil royalties that have just been given away, about $1 billion-plus tax benefits given by multinational corporations who spent $1.6 million to lobby for those things. The public is getting ripped off. But if it's a generalized story as opposed to specifics with who did what for what, it doesn't ring home. It doesn't get reported back home. So we want to have the information out there, have it utilized, make it harder for Congress to keep doing the bad things, easier for the public to spot them, not only reward the members who have nothing to hide, but punish those who do have something to hide. And if we get a new standard of transparency, by the way, we just gave Tanzania a $14 million grant to increase transparency in Tanzania, I think approximately half, the United States government, that approximately half that money would do us just fine here in the United States. So our goal essentially is to fulfill Brandeis's observation of some 70 years ago, bring the United States government, at least the Congress, into the 21st century, utilize the power of the computer and the internet to accomplish that. Those are our goals. Now, we'd love to hear, we're here essentially not just to tell you what we're doing, but this room contains people, some of whom are legends in their own time, others perhaps legends in their own mind. But in any event, to hear from you what it is that your reaction is to this, what you think we ought to be troubled about, maybe privacy concerns, what you think we ought also be thinking about, where you think we ought to be going from here. Thanks a lot for your time and your attention.
Thank you so much for telling the story. We've obviously got much more to discuss. There are some legends that we should absolutely get to, but just in terms of sort of tying this back to the Berkman Center's work and why this is, obviously essential that you're doing it, but also why I think we're particularly excited about what you're up to. A few years ago, we pulled together some people into a room about talking about how is the internet affecting politics. And most of it at the time was talking about how does it work in campaigns, the kinds of stuff that Andrew's campaign obviously brought to light and made this work with PDF. But one person in the room, Congresswoman Loughran, said, wait a minute, you have to think about this also about how it affects governance, right? What happens when we're actually governing? Are we opening up through internet or whatever else this process? And is it a virtuous feedback loop with citizens go through the campaigns and then in the governance space, and does that change at all? Is anybody paying attention? It seems like you guys have just nailed exactly that in terms of a focus and a way to affect it, which is just great. I may ask a follow-up question on it, though. I should think moderate to private, but you talk about having XML open stuff and APIs and whatever, which of course seems right to these in the room. That's exactly what we want. We don't want PDFs, we want XML and open APIs. But do you have a sense what people will do with it?
I've had some experience with it on a fairly limited basis. At the Center for Responsive Politics, we tried to sort of put together sub-data sets where if you were interested, or information sets maybe is a better way to put it, if you were interested in a particular piece of legislation like energy or oil and gas or something like that, you know, people would, you know, could go to the oil and gas section, and then they would see a bunch of different, you know, pieces of information that would inform them about how their member of Congress voted. The answer is, I think we don't know in terms of the average citizen. One of our goals is to, we certainly started out in this vein, is to make this reporting easier for investigative reporters. They will know precisely what to do with it. Because of the limitations on, I mean, the many reasons that the media, mainstream media, is dying, not the least of which is lack of resources and lack of time to do these kinds of stories. We know that this kind of accountability matrix is a name we're using for it, would speed them along. I think public's use of it remains a bit to be seen.
Yeah, let me just go back up one little cycle and tell you how we got to this conclusion. One of the other hats I've been wearing for about a year is a chairman of a president of an organization called the Penn Faulkner Foundation that gives peer rewards for literature, both novels and short stories. So I began thinking the way to get more exposure and put more pressure on people was to provide prizes for journalists. So with Ellen's help, we interviewed, I think, maybe about a dozen of the leading investigative journalists, and what they told us is the same thing over and over again. Prizes are nice, but the problem is, they use a BlackBerry term, you can't pull it, you got to push it. Because if they go to their editors today and say, I want to do a story on Joe Schmo or Congressman X, and the editor's going to ask the question, besides the question, is my 18-year-old reader of me is interested in this, is what tattoo Madonna has on which buttock? The answer is, it's going to take 2 or 3 months, and I'm not sure what I'm going to get. But if you could push the button here, we concluded, if all the information was accessible, it would be accessible to reporters as well as citizens, as well as bloggers, all over the country. They don't have to come to Washington and look into the bowels of the Senate building to find out what it is. So our basic principle here is that if we make all of this accessible, they will tell us. We're in Web 2.0 world. Yeah. The web will tell us. The users will tell us what they will do with it. And inasmuch as this is all presently publicly mandated information, we're not messing with the system at all. Yeah. We're just basically making the system work as it should. Now, we propose, you know, to basically take this, to build enthusiasm for it, and make, as Ellen said, make it more expansive, more on time, more online, real time. Because just imagine a world in which you knew that Company X and Company Y had basically entertained Congressman A and visited with him, and as a result, something was showing up in the committee report that was a special favor, whether an earmark or a special piece of legislation. You don't want to read about that and figure out those facts 6 months later, right, if and when information that might suggest that is on the report. Yeah. You want to have that information available so that we can have expressions of outrage at the time. Now, it is said that the legislative process is making sausage and nobody wants to visit a sausage factory. But the sausage is being made, and it's contaminated sausage. And the body politic is getting sick with it. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of problem by casting a little light on the sausage factory.
John, I just want to answer your question. We have some ideas about how this data might be combined. I'll give you one example. And I have to give credit to my brother, Technorati, for pointing this out. If you go to the Washington Post today on their website and read any story, there's a little box on the side that shows you blogs that are commenting about that story. Okay. What we'd like to see is a tool that any blogger or any news organization could use to place something similar on a page on the web that mentions a congressman. And that little box might be tailored to whatever the blogger or the news organization wants it to contain, but it could contain something like, you know, Congressman DeLay, and it lists their top five donors, and then a link to back to a richer site that has a lot more information about who's giving them money or specific interest groups or whatever it might be. The point is to get the information in a dynamic way where people are looking. People are reading a news story. Why not have it right alongside that news story? But that's just one idea. And I one of the things that Sunlight's going to do a couple of months down the road By the way, Ellen said this is a completely new idea. I mean, the foundation has not formally gone public yet. This is about as public as it's been, frankly, given that we're out on the web today. But one of the ideas is to offer to seek proposals from developers and offer mini grants for the development of transparency tools. And you know, it seems to us there are a lot of things that people out there would do, and all they need is a little bit of seed funding to go forward. And we'd like the foundation to be a seedbed for that.
Just to lend that out before handing it off to others, a theoretical basis for this. One of our colleagues, Jonathan Zittrin, who's a professor here at Oxford, he's written a paper which is going to be in the Harvard Law Review this year, and then a book called The Generative Internet. The premise is that the thing we should protect and celebrate with respect to internet from a legal and regulatory perspective is things on which you can build something else, right? And you don't know what those next layers are going to be, but things that are generative. It seems like exactly what you guys are doing is creating a generative layer off of which a citizen or an investigative reporter, who knows who it might be, might do something cool. So in that context, it seems perfect with that build.
This is very, very exciting, and I think it's lots of great ideas that you've got. I'll post the concern here about individual privacy. Because Brandeis, of course, is not only famous for talking about sunlight as a great disinfectant, he's also famous, as a lot of people in the room know, for writing the seminal Harvard Law Review article in the 1890s that essentially first posited that technology was going to threaten individual privacy, that these photographers, with their newfangled technology, were going to be broadcasting, that's not the word he used yet, information about the individuals into the public in ways that had not been possible beforehand. So I've written in law reviews about this tension. I don't think it's a tension with elected officials. You know, I mean, they've made a choice to put themselves in the limelight, and they're needed to be responsive to public concerns about their activity. But I'm thinking about sort of the individual donor who gives a small amount of money to a cause, possibly one that his neighbors don't think is a great one, and who before, you know, in the old days, you had to go look at those punch cards at the FEC to find out, and his neighbors couldn't sit in their pajamas in their bedroom and learn, you know, who they'd given money to. But as you're all aware, you can now call up mashups on Google Maps to see everyone in your neighborhood who gave to any federal campaign and how much and what house they live in. It seems like this raises a tension that runs in the opposite direction, and I just wonder how you can have the maximum benefit of sunlight but also sort of be concerned about the sort of $300 donor and their ability to take political action without necessarily going public to the world. The answer might be that's what is entailed in donation, but it's not clear to me that a $300 gift to John Kerry tells you, from a regular person, tells you much about John Kerry, but it tells you a great deal about the person.
Well, first of all, it's not an issue that we're raising. Mm-hmm. That information is already there, right, by dint of existing laws and existing internet searches, so wrong people to ask. My own view is it's part of the political process. Mm-hmm. And how would you do it? You'd say, if you're a normal person, is there a box that you check on?
That's my question.
I'm just a normal guy. I mean, as opposed to I'm an abnormal guy, or $300 is a lot of my money, but it's not very much your client's money. I mean,
I think that's already been decided, which is if you give less than $200, your name is not reported. So someone decided.
And if you're a lobbyist, you're recorded differently, right?
Yes. Well,
your campaign contributions are reported exactly the same. But
lobbyist, if you only do it once, you're not a registered lobbyist.
And I have certainly given a contribution of less than $200 because I did not want my name disclosed. And I think people who are players will do that. So maybe the level needs to come up or go down, depending on how you see this. But I think, what I'm glad to hear you say is that when you decide to run for office, you know, you buy into the system of accountability and disclosure, or you should. I couldn't agree with you more, although when I made the suggestion at this meeting, there were 15, I guess, advocates, you would call us, and five very progressive Democratic senators, and I suggested that they post their calendars on the internet. I thought that I was going to have to pick them up off the floor.
Well, but you know, there are privacy concerns there.
Let me apply the question to that. Uh-huh. The suggestion, because I was thinking of it and didn't put it in the question. There's an example of something you're talking about that does have that countervailing tension. How do you handle that? I mean,
yeah. Well, no, the staff came back to me and said, "What about the liberal Republican senator who wants to meet with the Human Rights Campaign Fund?"
Right.
And my response to that is, if you are a member of Congress, you ought to be able to defend who you meet with in every single instance to your constituents. It's a tough question,
What about from the advocate side? What about the advocate who, for whatever reasons, would not like the entire world to necessarily know that at this juncture they're visiting with Senator Smith?
I think we ought to just have everybody put on masks and duck. I don't understand. This is the political process. I really do. I see there's some privacy concerns here. I'll identify one to you. That's been identified to me. Presently, you can basically get FOIA, theoretically communications agencies, but an awful lot of what it is that congressmen or their offices do is to make sure that Mrs. Smith's Social Security check is being pursued. Do we really need that in the process? And
that's
how do we define that? That's a more real issue. People who are politically motivated and meeting for political purposes, there may be some small chilling effect, but the repulsive impact of the cumulative absence of disclosure and absence of sunlight and excess of electrolyte has to be weighed in the balance. And at the present moment, you know, 70-some-odd, in most of the polls, 70-some-odd percent of the American people polled believe that the process is corrupt. And I will tell you, and the students here can probably tell you because they're closer in age, my son's generation are completely turned off to the political process because they believe it is futile to engage against the massive impact of moneyed interests and the relationships that exist between money. That's a large part of what pushed me into this. So there's got to be a balance struck somewhere, and I don't think the balance is that too much on the privacy side, except with our genuine, narrow, personal privacy as opposed to political privacy issues.
Just segue to the next question. Yeah. We ran Generation Dean over here.
I keep thinking about Media Matters when I listen to you speak, and I noticed they did this interesting transition about a year ago. They used to send out emails to people and tell them, you know, here's an update on what people said yesterday that can make you angry. And then what they did is they transitioned to focusing on one or two of them and then asking people to take this action. And when I initially looked at Media Matters, I thought, you know, they're aggregating, they're doing research, and they're aggregating this research, but they don't have the organization to push it through the advocacy level. And so when I was looking at that, I thought, wow, what if they were kind of like the back end for a lot of organizations on the left? So they take their research, and instead of putting their resources into making it public and pretty, they were basically going to put together reports that could be accessible to the public that are intended for researchers and other organizations that have the capacity to run those campaigns and those agendas. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because I wonder, in this case, well, a member of the public might be inclined to go through all the information, especially once it's been reworked so it's easier for them to deal with. I think the key audience, like you said, are those investigative journalists, they are researchers, they are people who work at those institutes and organizations. So getting back around to your question on how to invest your energy, time, and resources, I mean, I think that's where you should go, and that's where you should push things. So while I like the idea of a graphic that people could put on their blog that says, here's what delays them, I kind of see that as like a second generation to the project. And the first part is identifying who are those researchers, what is their schedule, like you were saying. You know, the big problem is there's this delay. People want to talk about these problems, but by the time they've gone through the data, public attention isn't what it is. They can't write about it because it happened a year ago, and it's hard to push those stories on their editors. So I think really trying to figure out how to work the aggregation, assimilation process to match people's timelines and needs is the most important part of the project. And unfortunately, that doesn't answer the question of what do you have to put up there for the public. But I think that that is just such a tremendous service. And despite the fact that it might not be as pretty and as accessible in some ways, I think it would make a great difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of our work will be pitched toward the investigative researchers and journalists, partly because the leverage there is huge. So you get one of them on a story, you make that job easier, and presumably they have 100 readers or 1,000 readers or perhaps even more if it makes it to television. So there's no question that that will be one of our audiences. But I am convinced that people are pretty outraged about what happens in Washington, and whether their intersection is minimum wage issues or it's health and safety issues or education issues, that there are ways to draw people into this, you know.
They want the analysis on that data. They're interested in those issues. They're interested in the questions that they want answers to. And so for content on the site, it makes me think, instead of directing content towards the raw data, it's almost like you can report on how that data's been used.
That was a better formulation of my question. Mm-hmm. Where are you in the value chain of transparency here? How far are you taking?
Well, pool one is the data's got to be there.
Right.
Tool two is we're going to do tools to a tool building to basically show people how to use the data. Third point, sideways from your point perhaps, is that if you look at the graphs of printed media readership as opposed to blogger readership, recognizing there's still huge gaps between, and percentages are always easier on smaller bases, blogger readership is going up by, remember the 39% annually? Print media is going down 11%. So a large secondary interim place is the blogosphere and the people who are researchers. And, I mean, in this particular set, talkingpoints.com, John Marshall's doing a great job, and there are other people doing great jobs in this sector. I know I haven't met you before. I'm honored to meet you. But, you know, Dan Gilmore's efforts to build citizen journalism is essentially the confluence of what we're talking about. I think it is changing. It is evolving, and happily in a robust way. So I don't think we need to dumb down the data, if you would. I think, in fact, if we push it all together and enable more people to utilize it, I think we'll learn a lot without diminishing the ability to reach that first tier that you're describing, because I think there's at least three tiers.
Let's go to the IRC chat. There's a question coming from the Internet. Jason's going to channel for us here. Are there any members of Congress or the administration that support your efforts?
Publicly, no.
We've done very little outreach thus far. In fact, my meeting on the Hill last week indicates that we may have resistance to this, the whole notion of greater transparency from Democrats as well as Republicans, whether they're in the White House or in Congress. So, and I guess I should say that Mike and I and all of our colleagues are very much motivated not by partisan politics here. We know that Washington is controlled by Republicans now. I've been in this business for some 20 years. The issue of transparency has to be applied, you know, equally to Democrats and to Republicans, and that's where we're coming from, and that's we will maintain that. And we're trying to draw in groups of different, varying ideological persuasions into producing, working with us to produce the data, to participating in any opportunities we have to mash this together. So we hope to keep it very bipartisan.
Two more quick responses. One, this is our first present to anyone outside ourselves. So we have
very flattered by this.
Well, and we're flattered to be able to make this our first present. In the last couple of weeks, there have been three pitches by Republicans for responding your point and following up on Ellen's. Schwarzenegger, driven somewhat by California legislature, basically announced last week that he and his two senior staff's calendars will be posted and online and made available. The new Republican majority leader, who, of course, may have his own reasons for adopting that deck rather than another, basically says he's for increased disclosure rather than substantive regulation. And three, John McCain, quite some while ago, came out for, as he has been for quite a while, at the cutting edge of more disclosure as well as more regulation in this sector. So this is quite clearly not a partisan objective only. This is essentially an opportunity to open up the process.
One of the legends, David
Weinberg. How do they respond? How can they not say yes?
They find ways.
But what is it that they say? What's the politician's response?
Well, we haven't really gone to them yet.
Yeah, the first response that I had was, as we talked about earlier, which is, well, if we post every meeting we have, then I may not want to meet with a certain group who, you know, would be out of the mainstream of my particular constituency. And my response, as I said, is, you know, members of Congress need to be able to defend who they meet with to their constituents. The whole notion of posting calendars on the internet was so laughable to one of the senators. He said, imagine if I proposed that to my colleagues. And I said, yeah.
Well, this is quite amazing.
A staffer said to me, you know, there would be all kinds of technical problems. I said, like what? You know, the calendars are not kept electronically now. There's not, wouldn't be an easy interface.
Congress controls the websites. Congress provides and mandates the website, the software, and the contents of the websites. So it would take Congress generally to basically make them post it. Now, there happens to be some new calendaring software being developed out in Silicon Valley. We're trying to encourage the creator of that software to donate it to Congress as sort of a beginning place.
But most congressmen, frankly, they don't. The culture of their understanding prevents them from imagining a world where transparency would exist.
Yeah.
It's like they just can't fathom it. During my campaign, I use this line all the time, that Henry Ford once said, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster cars.
Uh-huh. And they would have said faster horses.
I'm sorry, faster horses. Sorry, forgive me. You can't get them. They're so addicted to top-down control that they immediately start thinking about what happens when I get a phone call from the writer who's going to publish it on page 6 of the Post that I said this or met with this, and then they lose it. They can't manage it.
The most powerful political event of my memory is something that happened about 12 years ago. When Newt Gingrich caused a bunch of congressmen to enter into the so-called Contract with America. And what we have been thinking about is developing essentially a transparency pledge and trying to make people pledge to that, therein posing them in a useful context as the 2006 elections come up, the question, answer your question, what's your problem with transparency? You just gave $14 million to Tanzania. You've passed all of these statutes requiring information. They're all supposed to be publicly available. What's wrong with making it really work by way of trying to get them to work even better? So the answer to that question, I'd rather not be as negative as Andrew just was. I'd rather be as positive as he once was when he said to me, the way to phrase this is essentially giving Congress, which is now besieged by people who believe them to be corrupt and involved, an opportunity to clean up their act in a way that doesn't cost them anything. It doesn't provide any comparative disadvantage of one over the other, and they need it. The country needs it, but they need it.
Are there any states or municipalities that have gone a long way toward what you're talking about where you could create a test bed?
I don't think anybody's gone quite this far because the information is not as robust at most state levels.
But even part of the way, I'm just saying, I mean, there must be places that are more that have more of the data available where you could test some of the things you're talking about.
Talk to the Oregon Secretary of State.
Yeah. One of the groups that we're going to be working with is a group called the National Library on State Money and Politics. It's headquartered out in Helena, Montana. When they developed a few years after, sort of off the model of the Center for Responsive Politics and does state data. And so we'll be having those conversations with them. There are some states that do disclose information, but very few of them get into the coding and the cleaning and the making of it accessible. They post it more like the FEC does. So
For the rest of you, coding and cleaning means that all these reports that get filed, if they just say Mike Klein, and we tried it with me actually, Mike Klein, just let's find out who he gave money to. Well, you know, I'm given a lot of options. When I'm asked to fill out that form, the question is, who is my employer? Well, I will tell you frankly, I'm associated with approximately a dozen different business organizations, and it's perfectly legal for me to put down a different one every time. And I, by the way, have more than one house, and I can put down different addresses. But who knows, really, that my client actually is CoStar Group, Inc., chairman, unless I make it easy for them. And that's what the hard slogging work of making that make the opensecret.com meaningful. That's really what's the value added, besides the fact that it's accessible.
I just want to add one point on this, and partly this is just to stir your imaginations a little bit. It may be possible to get to reward those individual members of Congress who want to be seen as transparent for doing some things that are not yet mandated. In other words, there is nothing preventing an individual member of Congress tomorrow from posting their calendar. I mean, technically, they might say it's a little complicated to get it onto the web, but frankly, we know that it's, you know, it's a trivial problem. They won't do it because the culture that they're in says, you know, there are all the reasons why they shouldn't. But we could collectively try to reward some people for doing the right thing even before it's law. You know, they have begun backing off on their lunches with lobbyists, even though they're legally still allowed to, you know, as long as they're not more than $50 or whatever the gift limit is. But some of them have voluntarily told their staff, stop having lunches with lobbyists. And so it strikes me that it happens to be a fertile moment where we have a culture of transparency on the web that a lot of us are accustomed to, and we have a lot of public officials who are ailing from this perception that they're all corrupt, and, you know, at least some of which would be happy to be seen as a lot cleaner if they would, you know, actually walk the walk.
Right. We've actually been, of course, not through the Sunlight Foundation, which is a 501c3, and not through the RC4, but having other discussions about how do you drive this into the political debate, and some have suggested having challengers to candidates take a personal pledge.
You have a point of leverage this year.
Yes, to take a personal pledge. The incumbent I'm running against has taken 1,000 trips. You know, I will never take a trip from a lobbyist. I will disclose everything, and so that is another discussion that's going on out there in the political world that we're interested in.
Before people have second shots, maybe you have this IRC. Or
yeah, another IRC question.
Go
ahead. Given the recent Abramoff scandal, there is supposedly reform legislation being considered now. Is there any chance any of this could be part of that effort or legislation?
Well, we'd like to see the transparency reforms become part of whatever reform package is passed. I think there will be something passed. I think it'll generally be pretty weak. But when I suggested the transparency reforms that we've discussed here, I was the radical in the room. People were willing to go for public financing, full public financing, which used to be the radical suggestion, before they were willing to go for the kind of transparency we've been talking about. So I think it'll be a big push.
There's one big overarching perspective that I think we should add, which is that the Congress currently wants to persuade the public that this is a lobbying scandal. What it really is, it's an extortion scandal. And so to the degree that they can separate it, that there's some bad apples who wave some money in front of us and we're going to get rid of them, doesn't go to the core issue, which is that they've created a culture that encourages people to wave money at them for them to act. And so that's why the transparency thing is so much more important than public financing or lobbying reform. It's actually oriented much more around changing the culture in which the public demands that Congress behave differently. So that's why the 501c4 is so important, because we can't just have the stick. We have to have the carrot and create a safe haven and reward those either candidates or congressmen who are willing to behave differently.
What's the difference between a 501c3 and a C4? I don't know.
A 501c3 is a tax-exempt public education organization. So creating databases, information, blogging, accumulating information and pushing it out to a general public audience is acceptable tax-exempt. Contributions to us can be tax-exempt. C4 is actually called a public welfare organization, and you can do grassroots lobbying in that guise. Neither a C3 or a C4 can engage in political activity at all.
Political activity meaning for formed candidates.
Electoral candidates.
As opposed to issues.
Both are tax exempt.
Their contributions to a C4 are not tax exempt.
They're not.
Right.
Okay. On the transparency issue with calendars, I want to get two views of this out of one story. I ran a political campaign in Portland, Oregon for the mayor's race, the last mayor's race that they had, with a, you know, let's say a minor candidate. There were essentially a bunch, it's a nonpartisan race. The mayor was resigning, and one of her city councilors who had been there for a long time was running. He had $3.5 million, which was like seven times the money that anybody had ever put into a Portland mayoral campaign. His contribution list looked like the Christmas party for the Developers Association in town. It was the developers, it was the real estate agents, it was their wives, it was their secretaries, where we actually found out that one of their secretaries had been given a $2,000 bonus from her boss.
Well, that's a no-no.
Yes, things like this.
Highly illegal.
And so we really kind of didn't want this guy to make the mayor's office. Tom Potter, who was in the Dean Dozen, was running for mayor, and a lot of the progressives in Portland wanted him to win. But a lot of the business folk was going to go behind this other guy because Potter had been the police chief and not a business person. So we fielded a business person to draw votes from the guy we didn't want to win. If we had published our calendar, it would have been really obvious how closely those two campaigns were working together. And that's part of politics. That is part of politics. And until we can educate the public, what you were talking about up there about engaging the politic, body politic, in understanding the data and the information and the issues as a hierarchy, you know, sort of getting that civic systems thing going, what you're doing by asking incumbents to publish their calendars is you're basically guaranteeing anti-incumbency will win every time, regardless of the position of the candidate who's the incumbent.
Well, at the present time, of the 435 seats in Congress, it is said that all but perhaps 40 of them are gerrymandered in a way that makes defeating an incumbent next to impossible. So restoring a little balance there wouldn't hurt anybody. But what you know, what you're talking about is a bit of political gamesmanship that I don't think is affected by what we're talking about. I think transparent. Well, yeah, I know you do because you put it the way you did. But fundamentally, letting people know who's contributing what to whom and making judgments on that has to be part of an open political process. If it's not, it's a Politburo kind of process. I don't.
But that's not contributions. That's meetings with people for strategy.
Same deal.
6 or 7 minutes up, so make sure Davika gets in a dividend.
Just wondering if there was a thought about how this transparency is going to end in a judgment, which I thought was, you know, the fact that hopefully we'll end up a report that can be used of we think this means this kind of positive. Will there be an opportunity for an answer, for responses from the people that these judgments are going to be made about? I know this report says that because I accepted money from X, this happened. But will there be? Are you guys thinking about a venue for them to respond?
Well, they have the world to respond, of course, and for the most part, the platform. I mean, you're essentially criticizing, engaging in a dialogue with public figures about their public conduct. And for the most part, if a congressman or his aide wants to utter a statement, the odds of it being covered by the press, particularly in a controversy, is slightly higher than a critic's observations about them.
So you're going to give one judgment, but not just like maybe this or that.
We're not going to do anything. We're not going to do judgments. We're making the data available for people who will then do judgments.
So you're not going to issue a report?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to
do. I think my sense is that we're probably not going to do reports per se, but we will probably have several blogs. In fact, we're negotiating with a very senior investigative reporter type at the moment who would use the blog format to both stimulate discussion about loose ends of things he turns up and to do some analysis. But it wouldn't be the long-term, it wouldn't be...
But then to her question, the person or campaign being
would have
talked
to,
about on that blog would have an opportunity to respond in place.
Yeah.
Of course.
I'm just saying it would be great if it was one spot. But there was one spot, so I didn't have to go look at the media for their response.
Gotcha.
I would know this more balanced, which makes it more credible. Right.
Sure. I mean, there has to be a way for people to respond to us, but I think Mike's point is people will respond, if the media picks up an analysis and says, Congressman X was caught with his hand in the cookie jar.
That's the meekest point, right?
Your blog will be the media at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And the difference to the extent this Web 2.0, other plugins, you plug in feedback on one way, you plug in feedback the other way.
Okay. One of the projects we're working on, which I'm dying to tell you about, I don't want to tell you about it, I know before, just yet, will include that capacity.
Tell us about it when it happens.
Yes.
It'll be soon.
Maybe a week.
Another month.
It's such a good idea that I know it would just go, you know, it would flower very quickly. So, but the notion is well taken. But, you know, one of Ellen's first comments to me when she kind of pulled me into this was she gestured to these reports that sit, you know, behind her desk that just gather dust. I mean, there are many, many, many reports that just, they have no legs to them. And so to go to Amanda's point, you know, part of the challenge is figuring out not just to deluge people with more information, but to enable action to follow. And judgment to follow, but ultimately the judgment is in the hands of the voters. And you know, we would like people to be better informed. You know, we're going to do our little bit to push the needle in that direction.
Dan, David, and Amanda, I want to make sure everybody gets.
I think I want to see your meetings up on the web too.
Start doing my funders.
I'll show you mine if you show me yours.
Yeah, we're committed to transparency. There's only one funder so far. he's in the room.
I have questions at both ends of the stack. So, at the low end, are you talking with people about standardized data formats for the different types of data that you're using? Can you use what's there? Or are you inventing your own? At the other end, do you have something that makes it easy for, say, a congressperson or a candidate, more to the point, to say, I've taken the Sunlight Pledge, and we know what that entails, that there's a set of, you know, 10 things I promise to do?
Was your question? I mean, we're in the process of sort of thinking through what that pledge would look like and how we would want to play it out. That we can do as a 501c4.
Yeah.
We'd have to help you write that if you put that out.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And we basically have discussed that as well.
And we've thought about, you know, distributing like a good housekeeping seal of approval that they would then certify themselves.
Or self.
And on your first point about data sets and standardization, any new data sets that are created will be created on an existing model, probably the one the Center for Responsive Politics uses. But there are so many data sets out there that we're going to have. One of the challenges is going to be, how do you put it all together when they're based on different formats? Yeah. But if we're looking at revolving doors and contracts, which are sort of first in our sights, we would try to use a fairly standardized format.
And we're working with a group, again, I think it's premature to identify them or describe it, but a group that has software that's capable of pulling together even diverse formats and making that available in a single place.
But David,
the objective is essentially where your question leads you, to make it accessible as easy as possible on multiple data sets that can be interrelated and thereby made usable for them. Any tier.
But in order to support the full disclosure from our side, one of the problems is that all these silos of data that are housed in different organizations, the organizations themselves are kind of old school and haven't quite fully come to terms with the fact that their data, which defines them and gave them their, you know, the phone call from the Washington Post reporter that they're going to get quoted in, may be out there in the public. And so we have to go through a major lobbying effort ourselves among our peers, so to speak, to get them to understand that this is in the benefit, the organism as a whole benefit.
Or find ways to accommodate both interests, which is quite possible.
Mm. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Amanda?
On the reports, when Dan was talking about, you know, about the election coming up, I think the context is equally important. So choosing that moment in time that makes the reward meaningful, but also something that people can understand and then act upon. And so I guess to that end, just in terms of general strategy, and you have so much to work with, but I think just being a bit opportunistic and picking an issue that's going to come up in the future and really nailing that particular issue and using that to drive the organization as a whole, as opposed to going for a broad-based approach, might help provide more initial attention and energy, because then you'll have the bloggers who want to write about that one issue and who can then have the graphic to identify, where did I get this information from? Sunlight, you know. And so I think something like that might be an easier way to get the engines rolling, but it's a little bit of a gamble because you're trying to foresee what comes up. I mean, other things sort of work a little bit more like a trickle-down effect, but I think picking one issue and really arriving with it
I mean, we want to be really careful not to duplicate any of the terrific analysis, data collection that these groups, media is already doing on their own. If we can catalyze it and, you know, find ways to simplify it and put it in the hands of citizens, provide some new tools, et cetera, that's kind of where we're going, which is, you know, when...
And I think she's making a different point. She's saying as we come up to the 06 elections... how do we maximize the opportunity to do something affirmative? And the answer is that if your consultancy is negotiable, we'll continue this conversation afterwards.
But I guess another one
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think the loss of a few good heads could get those balls rolling, to mix a metaphor.
Well, I think we should let folks who need to escape. And if you guys will stick around for a few minutes, I just want to keep on talking.
Great.
Do it. And otherwise, please join me in thanking our guests for their great presentation.